Father Joseph Ryan here in Terranure College. Now, I suppose born in 1928.
28, yes.
And how long are you here in this college?
Well, I came here in 1954. I was here till 64. Then I was sent into White Friar Street, where I remained until 1985, during which time I became provincial of the Carmelite Order in Ireland for 7 years. And I returned here then in 85 until 91. And from 91 to 97, I was prior in Kildare. And I come back here in 97, and I've been here since.
My goodness. But
most of my life,
yes,
has been here.
But let's go back to the very beginning. Let's take it from the start. You're a Kildare man.
Yes.
What part of Kildare?
Kildare town. In fact, I was born within 100 yards of the Carmelite spire, which dominates Kildare town, and indeed the Curraside around. So I was very familiar with the Carmelites from infancy, and grew up as a choir boy and an altar boy in the Carmelite church. So,
What was it? Did you come from a farming background?
No, my father was a businessman. He had a thriving business in Kildare, a shop, and he originally had come from County Mayo. Both my father and mother were from Mayo. And he came over there originally and was managing a cooperative. And eventually then he went out on his own. And he was a very successful business, if I may say so, and a very, very good one. He'd all the old instincts for.
And how many brothers and sisters in the family?
In the family, one sister, the oldest, and three brothers.
And
another
you...
of whom is a Carmelite.
Oh, really? Two Carmelites?
Yes.
So, were you the youngest or in the middle?
No, I was in the middle.
Yes.
I was number three. My sister, the oldest, then an older brother, who's dead, Lord rest him. Then myself. Then a brother just next to me, younger than me, who's also a Carmelite. He's in Kildare too, as it happens.
Yeah, and did you want to become a Carmelite because did that help?
Well, I suppose it helped him. I kind of paved the way, but he would be a man who would have had his own mind. We were very familiar with the Carmelites and with what they were doing and what they stood for, and we rather liked it, and it was a natural progression from being an altar boy or a choir boy. Yeah. When you thought of a priesthood, and you felt that type of life was the like life you wanted to embrace, and he followed along after me. He was very much an academic. He was a scripture scholar, and spent a lot of his time in Rome, in the Biblicum in Rome, and in the Holy Land, mm-hmm. where I more or less stayed at home here most of the time.
Your schooling, you went to local school there?
Went to the De La Salle Brothers, Presentation Sisters initially, De La Salle Brothers afterwards for my primary and secondary education. I couldn't say enough about both institutes. They were marvellous, marvellous in every way, because, look back with great affection and great respect. They were good disciplinarians, but there are lots of human qualities too, you know, and very good teachers. And we had a marvellous Latin school, as it happened.
And of course, Latin was part of the curriculum in those days.
It was, yes. And unfortunately, it became over-identified with the Latin of the church, as it were. It didn't stand on its own two legs as it should have, as one of the classics. We had a lay teacher who was a Bachelor of Divinity. He had been a clerical student, Joe Darcy, in the secondary school, and he was an absolute genius, marvellous knowledge of Latin, and also he was a marvellous teacher. He could impart it. I remember on one occasion, we were in second year now, which wouldn't be, no, third year, pardon me. And a department inspector arrived, as always in that time, unannounced. And his particular subject on that occasion was Latin. Now, we found out afterwards that he was a very, very senior person in the department. In fact, shortly afterwards, he became secretary of the department. Michal Branagh was the name. And he came in and found a lively 13, 14-year-olds. And he decided he'd test us. So he put a sentence up on the board. Caesar went to Rome to see the games. And he said, I'll give a bright, shiny half crown, which was a fortune in that time, to any boy who could translate that in five different ways into Latin. Of course, the poor man expected that we'd look on in disbelief, that it was possible, and in fact that if any of us could do it even one way, we'd be happy. But as it turned out, every kid in that class knew exactly what was involved.
My goodness, yeah. Sorry.
So he looked, everybody put up their hand, and in consternation almost, disbelief, he looked over at the teacher. The teacher was standing inside the window with his arms folded, with a big grin, which was like Mona Lisa. He didn't know what to make of it. So anyhow, he looked around and picked what I suppose wasn't the brightest looking boy in the class. He felt that if he was going to lose his half crown or even go near it, that he better hedge his bets a bit. See, this lad came out, and he wasn't by any means the brightest in the class, but he knew his Latin. And as fast as he could, he screeched the old chuck.
Imagine that. Yes.
In five different ways immediately. Yeah. Well, the man was stunned. He just called the teacher out and we didn't see him for the rest of the day. So the superior told us after, the head brother, Brother Benedict, he said he had never met the like of it in his whole career as a professional educationalist.
And who was your teacher? Who was teaching you Latin?
This man, Joe Darcy, was his name.
And was he from the town?
No, he was a Galway man. He was a Galway man, and he had been a clerical student. How far he went, we couldn't be sure, but we knew he had a Bachelor of Divinity, which meant that he had gone 3 or 4 years in a place like Maynooth. Yeah. But he was a marvellous, marvellous, and a marvellous teacher of English, as that happened as well. But I mentioned that in passing because it was exceptional. But the De La Salle brothers, the Presentation Sisters, absolutely thorough, led us away with nothing. And at the same time, there was a very happy atmosphere. Mm. There was plenty of sport. The Kildare I grew up in, it was just at the end of the golden era of those famous games with Kerry. Kildare had just a few years previously, it had won 6 Leinster titles in a row, something that no team has done since. And I'm sure your own forebears have told you about the mighty finals in the 20s, 1927, 28, when sometimes there was only a point between the two sides. Lots of people would say that the great Kildare-Kerry encounters built the GAA as we know it. It gave it a whole new life in the 20s and 30s.
They were the great games of the time.
Great games, different style. Of course, it was the catch and kick style. Yeah. Very different to what we have now. And they didn't have the all the concentration on.
Did you play yourself?
I did. I played 2 years for the Lily Whites as a minor, 1945 and 46. We didn't get anywhere. I played in the right half forward position. I loved the game. We were fanatical about it, and of course it helped you every way. You only realized afterwards how important games are to boys. Doesn't matter whether they're good at it or not. That's secondary. The important thing is that they're out. They're in a team situation. They learn to have to work with others. You make friends. You make friends for life during your sporting days, even more than from the classroom. Mm-hmm. The boys you knock around with on the playing field tend to be, and I've seen it even here. Remember, an odd time you get a very worried parent who'd be worried about the here in the college and looking for reasons to why Junior mightn't be doing as well as he should. And the first emphasis would be maybe there's too much sport. And I would always say there isn't enough.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll come to that because the college was a great college for sport.
And still is.
All
and
sport,
still is,
yeah.
Yes.
But just before we finish with Kildare, you saw yourself going in, that you wanted to become a Carmelite.
Yes, yes.
And as did your brother. And I'm sure a lot of other lads locally as well, were they?
Well, a certain number. Kildare wasn't always the best of places for vocations. It didn't have the great vocation tradition now that that you have in your own county or Tipperary or so many other places. Like if you take the great missionary institutes of the last century, the Minute Mission to China, the Dalgan Park Men, or the Sacred Heart Missionaries in Cork, or St. Patrick's in Kilteegan. The number of Kildare men, somebody said, Kildare people were never over gospel hungry. Very good people, but there just wasn't that type of clerical tradition. There were always a few. As a matter of fact, the vocations in Kildare were all around my own part of the town. There were two men just above me, two brothers who became oblates of Mary Immaculate. Across the road, just a few doors down, was another priest, Bill Jones, who spent his life in the American mission in Mobile in Alabama. And a few came on after me, but nothing like, I think, the southern Tipperary and Kerry and Limerick and Cork and the West, Galway and Mayo. They seemed to excel.
Yeah.
Whether it was filling Maynooth or filling these missionary institutes. And happened.
Where did you go? Where were you?
Well, I was sent to UCD to do a BA and higher diploma. After that, for philosophy, I was sent, and for theology, I was very fortunate. I was sent to Rome and was ordained there, and then was kept there for a year's study after ordination, and found it hard in the beginning, hard to acclimatise. But afterwards, once we settled down, it was a totally different culture, of course.
And how many years? Was it seven?
4 years there.
Four years.
4 years there, yes. And different culture, different way for doing things. And you miss the green, green grass. I suppose it had its compensations in that you were, you know, you were seeing the mother of all cities, you know, the eternal city itself. You were there for all some wonderful ceremonies in the life of the papacy. Pius XII was there in my time. I was there for both the beatification and canonization of the great Pope St. Pius X. That time, you didn't see too many people either, because air travel, as we knew it subsequently, hadn't taken off.
What year was that?
In 1950. Yeah, so the air travel was a luxury.
Yeah.
We went out by boat, you know, and travelled overland by train, which is very interesting.
You wouldn't have met Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty over there, would you?
Yes, he did indeed. The Scarlet Pimpernel, as he was known. He was on his last few years there. He was very disappointed in the end. He did an awful lot of work. Kerry man, he did marvellous work during the war in concealing Jews in the Vatican. And what is not known so well too, he was able to get a lot of food, a lot of meat from the American troops for the people inside the Vatican, who were virtually on the point of starvation. Because there was a very bad period there during the occupation with the Germans, when people were literally, they were literally on their uppers.
That's right. And
but he did marvelous work there, and he did marvelous work, and everything that's been said about him, as he deserved it. And in fact, I often think he still has to get the recognition that he was due. And of course, I might add that he was one of the people, he couldn't have done it without the patronage of Pius XII, whose reputation from some people, you know, has suffered considerably. Pius XII did an awful lot for the Jews on the quiet, an awful lot. And so many people have tried to blacken his name over the years. But like the Jewish rabbi in Rome at the time, who ultimately converted to Christianity, he couldn't say enough about the efforts of Pius.
So after 4 years, you made your way back to Ireland.
I was assigned to Turner College. You'd be at that stage, you'd be very docile. You wouldn't have too many choices. You might have some likes or dislikes, but you were glad to have gotten through the rigours of seminary life, because it is fairly tough. You have lots of exams to qualify you, and you also have a lot of what we call scrutinies by your superiors. In any seminary, the seminary staff, guided by the master of students or the dean, will be there to see what caliber you are and what you're made of, and whether you're up to ultimately the life you propose to live. You've big decisions to make yourself. Nobody coerces you, so you've total freedom in which to think about the long term. You haven't any doubt in your mind about what's facing you. So that by the time you come, if you get as far as ordination, you know, you're pretty well.
You've made it.
Yes.
You're over the.
Yes,
the hurdle.
You've made your own decision, and you're glad then that the order or the diocese, as the case may be, is willing to accept you, present you to a bishop for ordination.
Now, so, did you know Turnure College before you came here? Had you
not
ever
terribly well. I knew it by repute, and I knew to the anecdotal conversations of various priests who were at school here and subsequently were in Kildare, or who worked here for periods and subsequently found themselves working in Kildare. So you knew a fair bit that way, but you never know any place really till you live in it.
Yeah. What year was it when you first came here again?
54.
54.
Yeah.
What was your first assignment? What were you?
Well, you were assigned to teaching to do your higher diploma in education, and you were assigned to teaching, and if it was felt that you could contribute, because some men could be very erudite, would be unable to, might have a disciplinary problem with kids, mightn't be able to control them, just, or mightn't just have any tastes for teaching. You know, it's a vocation too.
No, describe the college to me in 1954 when you came
1954,
here.
1954, it was, I suppose we were arriving at a time when the whole area was beginning to develop. And that was putting its own pressures on the college. It was the college largely and essentially was a boarding school that took in day boys. And you could see quickly that it was going to be a day school that took in boarders. And you wonder which was going to win out and predominate. So there were decisions to be made. Now, not immediately, but as the building boom mushroomed around here, there were a lot of green fields here in the area in 54 that in 56 were covered over in concrete. There was a massive building boom and a massive demand for houses. And consequently, as they say about infrastructure nowadays, pressure on places in the school. So eventually, by about in the early 70s, there was a strong feeling that maybe the time had come to consider just a day school and expand in that way. And there was a lot of soul searching within the community because a number of the men who were here had been boarders themselves. So there was a lot of sentiment involved. And it was a long tradition of boarding in the college. But eventually, after lots of discussion within the community, it was presented to a provincial chapter in 1973. That was during my own time as provincial. And it was decided that the entire Carmelite body, the entire province, that it just wouldn't be a house decision, that the entire Carmelite fraternity in Ireland, many of whom had been at school here, would all have a say. So the pros and the cons, there were a certain number, I use the word diehard for want of a better word, who felt, we should maintain the boarding tradition. But the majority felt that life had changed, times had changed, the area had changed, and that really we would meet the needs of the church even in a better way if we concentrated on being a day school. And that's what happened. So in 73, there was a decision made at the chapter by a very, very substantial majority. I suppose there was virtually 95% to phase the boarding out. So it was phased out over a 3-year period. Mm-hmm. And all the facilities for boarders, insofar as they could be, were converted to day use.
Now, backtrack again a bit to 1954. You came in teaching. What age students were you teaching?
Well, I was assigned to the junior school. They would be 8 to 12s, who are would be correspond to primary. And they'd be the more difficult ones to teach, in the sense that at least the 12 and 13-year-olds who have begun secondary school have a certain sense of responsibility that there's an intercert and a leaving cert ahead. So in some way you have a focus and a goal, and they begin to realise that without these qualifications, at least at that time, if they didn't get a matric, they weren't going to be able to go to the university. So there was it was in a certain sense, it was easier to control them. Whereas with smaller children, as you learn in the higher diploma classes, keeping them focused.
Yeah.
And being able to give them the right type of material.
Were the kids, were they a mixture of boarders and day pupils, or were they
a older? Small number of boarders, because the under 12s among the boarders weren't more than half a dozen to a dozen.
Mm-hmm. Were offerings kept in the school, children?
No.
At any stage?
No, it was always a private boarding school where parents
sent their children,
made a deliberate choice,
Right. But, I can imagine a young boy coming in here at the age of 12, 13, 14, but a younger, a child,
yes,
8 years old.
Yes,
that must have been very hard.
Yes, well, sometimes, mostly it was the best of a lot of maybe not so good options. It was the lesser of two evils, if you want to put it that way. And we were loath to take small children, except we felt we were really helping towards a solution that otherwise parents wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. That was because you could see, you'd know that small kids were a little bit at sea. You'd know they were missing one or both parents.
Yes.
But sometimes the home situation, where there was a separation or some circumstances that made a decision like that inevitable. You notice the children. I mean, I must say the priest responded to that very well. Then we had a matron, a resident matron, and she generally took good care of the small kids, and she was the mother figure, if you like. Now, there weren't that many at any time. I think, as I say, I doubt if there were any more than 10 in my time over the 10-year period I was here initially.
Yeah.
But the matron was the mother figure, and they sort of warmed to her in a lot of ways and went to her in a lot of ways in the ways they might go to the mum at home.
What was her name?
The first one, and I'm just thinking there were a few of them. One of them was Miss Cronin, was one. Then there was Eileen Byrne was another. And there was Celia Costello, who became a medical missionary in the later years of her life.
Yeah. No, you were conscious of the need to, if you like, do the job of a mother.
Yes, you would.
What about the regime now? Because it from my memory, being in Turnier College, there was a fairly strict regime, getting up early in the morning.
Oh yeah, well, you'd have to have that. You couldn't run a place at all. I mean, you'd have to have. I know the kids would recognize they might be sleepy and might like a sleep on and that, but they recognized that that they had to get up, and there'd be a routine for the day. Me and going down, there always that time just mass, morning mass was an accepted fact, and then they went into breakfast. And they were free then till class began. And they went, the rest of the day then was in total union with the day boys, except that they stayed back and went to their own dining room for their lunch. And they were out then after school for the games and that with the others. They went into study, of course, a bit earlier than the day boys. That was the thing that I probably found hardest. But it was for that reason that a lot of them were in boarding schools, because parents would find that they wouldn't be able to discipline them at home. Now, you didn't have the two jobbing parents very much that time. Later on, as we know, both parents now are out working, both of them trying to pay a mortgage.
So was it a kind of within your brief, say, to instill discipline into the boys?
Yes. Well, you were trying to give them, basically you were trying to give them the gospel values of hard work, virtue, behaving themselves, broadly speaking, keeping the ideal of the Ten Commandments, or the Beatitudes before them, the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are the poor in spirit. You try to impart that to them in your own language, give them a sense of responsibility. You knew that some of it would be going in one ear and out the other, but you accept that. But that, as the years go along, that a certain amount of it, a good amount of it, sticks. Mm-hmm. And you see, you were very, the school at that stage was very well supported by the home. That's probably the essential difference in modern life. The school got great backup. See, the parents, the church has always recognized that the parents are the primary educators. They delegate that to the schools. It's no more than a delegation. But since they're out trying to earn their bread and keep a roof on a house, they expect then that responsible teachers delegated by them will teach children all the things they would like to teach themselves. So they would be sent to a school, to a Catholic school like this, because it would hopefully instill Catholic values. As I say, the Beatitudes, the Ten Commandments, the broad notion that, you know, you love and respect and honour your neighbour and their goods and their life, and good citizenship. And also that you prepare yourself morally and intellectually for adulthood. Mm-hmm. And that it's a gradual process, like the small kids, their intake is, you know, you don't get frustrated. You recognise that you're going to have to say the same thing 100 times. Because if you get very frustrated if you think that, you know, everything you ask, you're going to get it like you would have an adult. I remember one poor man, he was very idealistic. He didn't last too long in teaching. He came in with an essay some kid had written. And the thing was, it was an historical essay. And he was explaining to the community, he said, read that for rubbish. Read that for rubbish. And nobody was terribly surprised. They knew the character involved even. But they weren't expecting what was going to come out. He said, I asked them 5 times, did they understand what I was saying? And they all said they did. At which the place erupted, because kids would say that, you know. Like, it's a game. It really is a...
Is it really?
Oh,
is
yes, it a game? It's a battle of wits. Oh, yes. You have to...
Did you like that? Did you love your job?
You love it. You love the kids because, you know, you recognise they're, you know, they're like putty to some extent in your hands. You know, a lot of the convincing of what's right and good is largely going to depend, you know, their values in life are going to largely depend on you, you know, giving them examples and pushing them on towards an ideal, and with the support of their parents. That is one of the big problems. Now, there are many good parents who still support, you know, the work in the schools. But where there is no real backup in the homes, and unfortunately in an increasing number of homes, there isn't the quality backup that you need. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kids find it very hard too.
So how many years then before you actually took charge, that you were actually in charge?
Well, I was in charge after I went out of here.
Yeah, you went out first and then you came back. So you were here for how many years?
I was here for 10.
10 years.
And then I was sent into Whitefriars Street as bursar.
How many years did you...
I was 5 years in there when I was elected prior provincial, mm-hmm. which would be the in charge of all the whole operation, Carmelite operation in Ireland and Zimbabwe.
But you,
the mission in Zimbabwe.
The missions in Zimbabwe.
Yes.
But you were here for 10 years.
Yes.
From 1954 yes. to 1964.
Yes, yes.
And now you wouldn't have seen a lot of change in that time, or would
no,
you?
No, you wouldn't. No, no. But it was gradual. That was there, but it was gradual. As I said, mainly dictated by the pressures from outside. New, more parents... Looking for places.
Was there a great emphasis? We spoke about the games and all the great games
yes,
here.
Yes, yes.
Was there a certain amount of pride or being proud of the Turn Your Colours and wearing the Turn Your Colours and, Well, you see, being part of Terranure College.
Yeah, well, kids take to that kind of naturally, you know. You don't have to work on that. There, you know, there's a certain tribalism, I think, in all of us. And it's probably an accident of circumstances that you're in one school rather than another, you know, where the parents are functioning very often. And you know that certain parents, very often the nature of their work has them moving house. And, sometimes, good distances so that kids can feel for a while, all their loyalties are in one place and their friends. Suddenly then the father gets promotion or whatever, or something, better prospects, something, let's say. And he may have to, the difference between Dublin and Cork, let's say, or Dublin and Galway, you know. And that can be, it can be big upheaval for kids. But you don't have to teach them the things. They're in the songs, you know. It's something they absorb. You don't have to concentrate on that. Your main concentration is on their moral rectitude and their academic excellence, you know. Really, they're the two things that you're
Well,
focused on. The rest falls in, as it were.
now, would there be a certain amount of if you took a student and you saw him playing well on the rugby pitch,
Yes.
but he wasn't good academically,
Yes.
would more attention be paid to that boy to bring him along a little bit?
Yes.
Because
Yeah.
he was doing well for the college out there.
No, I
Was
know.
there
No,
that
you would. No,
emphasis?
you. No, you would know. Any kid. I'll put it this way. Any boy at any time, who was anxious for an extra bit of tuition, if he was a bit behind, he got it, without question. Teachers were always anxious there to bring them on. Each teacher would have his own group. Now, you see, nowadays there's so much distraction at home. First of all, the parents are out, as I say, trying to pay a mortgage, maybe both of them out. So they're conscious that there won't be. Kids won't apply themselves. They don't have that real sense of responsibility. You just can't expect them to have it. So they won't do much work. So if they're a bit behind, you have a lot of this college now, everywhere, all the colleges provide amenities now for study in the evenings. Lots of the day boys, after sport is finished, they may take something in the canteen or they may go home for their tea. But they're back for 2 hours. They're back to about 9 o'clock, particularly the exam classes, the fourth year and sixth year. They come back where there's a better environment. So the modern houses, some are a bit small, maybe smaller children. Father and mother may want to watch TV, or some of the small kids, or whatever, noise distraction. So it's easier for them to come back. And then there's an atmosphere because a number of others are in the same boat. So they feel. The team thing is there.
When you look at Terranure and you see this stone wall all around it, and you think of what's going on inside, and
Yes.
you think of yes, what do you in a way become institutionalized when you're in here for so long?
I wouldn't like to use the word institutionalized, but I think that it does good. The sabbatical idea, which is much more prevalent now than it was. You see, a teaching community, you need to be able to stabilize it. And if men start off teaching and are good at it, the only way to run a school is to hopefully keep them at it. And I agree that there are problems. I won't say great ones, but how would I put it? There are problems of vision, if you like, problems of modernization, problems of probably having a better handle on the world around you. If you can step back for a year, go abroad, take up something else, you suddenly see other dimensions to your life in Terranure, and you come back after a sabbatical. The sabbatical in the old days, the department didn't recognize it.
But it was necessary. Did you feel it was
It
necessary?
always was necessary, and it's recognised now, of course. Recognised everywhere. In fact, it's recognised in business even. Good business good business will see that men don't get into a rut, however perfect and devoted they are. So I think I wouldn't like to use the word institutionalization, because it's always been a very happy place for the priest and a very happy place for the kids. Now, of course, they prefer a lot of the time to be out kicking football than in listening to somebody expounding a theory on the blackboard. We all know that. But, like, you know, no matter where you are, life is that way. You have to do the work.
How about the, you know, your contemporary, the other priests here? Did you gel well, or
yes, well,
had you any falling out? Or
of course you'll have a certain amount. Yeah, of course you will. All human life is there, and all you have in common is a habit and a rule of life.
How many of you here in
the 12 in the 1960s? I can remember in the 1960s there were 28. Priests, and the oldest was 38.
My goodness, is that right?
Yes.
And how many of those 28 were teaching?
They were all
teaching.
All teaching, yes, all teaching. Oh yes.
And so there weren't that many lay teachers.
There were a few, but the proportions increased as the intake increased and as the number of priests dropped. We're 12 now. 12 priests now. But as I say, the institutionalisation, you see, the parents love the place. There may be a wall all round, but the gates are always open night and day. And that's certainly symbolic, because lots of the parents will tell you the families were reared here at a time when they couldn't go to Spain on a cheap Ryanair flight for €9, whatever it is.
But the gates might be open, but the...
But the kids came in here and they were there when the fields would be, the grass would be growing, and after the sports were over for the summer, they would turn into hay. And, you know, the priests out, because we still, when I came here, we still had a little farm here, you know.
Yeah.
And we had cattle on the place still.
Yeah.
And that, I say, gradually changed too. I remember we'd pigs during the famous swine fever epidemic. We'd an old sow, and however she broke out of the pen, she was found wandering on the Temple Oak Road, and there was absolute war with the department.
And I remember myself, the milk coming fresh from the cows, and it wasn't pasteurized either. It was
no, not that stage, not that stage, but all that changed, you know.
Yeah.
The dairy board and various things. So,
but actually, just again, you know, to try and feel that you were part of Terenure College, but you also felt that you were, I'm talking about borders now,
where yes.
probably felt like there was this wall, even though the gate was open, you couldn't go out.
They felt confined. It was a great cheer the day they'd be going home.
That's right.
Oh, yes. Like, everybody knew that. But then you found some of them back a couple of days early. They would miss their friends. And
did that happen?
Oh, it did happen. Well, yes. You'd have some of them coming quite early.
Yeah.
And delighted to be back with their friends. Bored stiff at home.
Yes.
Now, not all the circumstances would be like that, but you'd meet that. I'd say, like, it was a very happy place. And kids were coming, no matter what school they'd be in, they'd be coming. There has to be a program. There has to be an horarium. There has to be a sequence, or nothing gets done. But it was a very happy place. And there was tons of sport for them, you know.
Yeah. And when you moved out then down to Sing Street, wasn't it?
Whitefriars Street.
Whitefriars Street. Did you miss it?
Absolutely. I was devastated. I shed a tear. I freely confess I shed a tear.
Did you know?
Yeah, I did, yes. I
even though you weren't that far away, but still.
No.
But you were leaving.
The whole way of life. It was a whole way of life going into a totally different way of life. Now, as it happened, I quickly got to like what I was doing in there too.
Now, what was your brief?
Bursar. It was bursar.
And what
which
did
meant,
that contain?
Well, it meant, in effect, the material administration, the big complex of buildings there, and all that had to be maintained. You had to ensure that You'd staff to clean it. Painting. You take any big complex, it has to be maintained. There has to be some driving force behind it to get tradesmen in, plumbers, electricians, whatever, because there's always some sort of maintenance to be done. And then you're in charge of the kitchens, what food is brought in, staff to cook it, all that area. Like, as I say, the material administration of the place.
So you were in
I've been
charge of
born
running the place, really.
in that sense, yes. But the prior, of course, would be the head of the community.
Yeah, but you were watching the finances and
All of that, all of that. And I suppose it was a throwback to my childhood, because my father, Lord rest him, involved me very much as I was growing up
Oh,
in his own
interesting.
affairs. Well, as we were growing up, he was making good use of us, in a number
Well,
of areas where he
you were
fit.
involved in the business at home as
Yes,
well.
in that,
Yeah. So you
we
had
didn't have any
you
say in running it, but
yeah.
there were plenty of jobs to be done.
So you knew the
So,
value of money and how to
exactly,
use it.
exactly, and
And how was it in those days? How was the finances? Were
well, you had
they?
to work. You had to work. You had to work for it. You had to work hard for it. Taking in money never came easily, but it would go out as fast as it would come in, because there's always something to be done. I remember actually getting Dockrell's was it was burnt down afterwards. They had a big timber yard and joinery not far from Whitefriars Street, and they had a very good service there. They had a tradesman for virtually every need. They had a carpenter, electrician, plumber, plasterer, bricklayer. And it was at a time when it is, as it still is, very difficult to get anybody to do a job. So we were very fortunate in that they were next door. And as the needs would arise, you got up the appropriate tradesman. But I found myself after about a year that I was constantly sending for the joiner man, the carpenter. There was a chair to be a table to be something, windows, sash cords gone,
All
always something,
that.
And I said to him one day after about a year, I said, "Jim, do you think is there a full-time job for a carpenter around here?" And he looked at me, knocked his cap back in his head. He said, "By hell, there is, Father." I said, "I was seeking that, but at the same time, I didn't want to commit myself, to a full-blooded tradesman, and the rates would be, they'd be reasonably good, and you'd have to pay him, and you'd have to ensure that because he had tenure with where he was, he was a fixture, and if I took him in, I'd have to
Oh, yes, look after
give
him.
him the
Yeah,
same,
yes, you, yeah. Yeah.
So I waited up and chatted with the community and with the prior and that, and they more or less said, "Well, go ahead if you really think." So it was one of the best decisions I ever made, because he was never a moment idle, and I met him every morning. We got him a workshop eventually down in the basement. There were extra rooms there that weren't being used. And he had all his tools neatly up on the wall, and it was the time of Black and Decker, so
Yes.
they were down in Kildare. There were various little things coming in the market. Got him a circular saw, so he didn't have to be heaving with a handsaw through a 12 or 14 foot board. He could just run this thing through the,
Through the temper.
But I remember when Archbishop Fulton Sheen, the famous American televangelist, was coming. We had to build a kind of a mini stage for him,
Oh,
and
yes.
other things, because there were going to be very big crowds in the church, and we had to think of various safety precautions. So Jim was very much in demand. So I had given him a list. He was always about 4 months behind with the jobs. He was never with, there with nothing to do. Though he's a very good worker, but there was so much on his list that when he'd finish one job, and he was 4 months behind, but they weren't urgent. But when you're coming to Fulton Sheen, it was only day 48 hours. So I said, "Jim, we'll have to change the priority," which we did, do this. But half an hour after it came down, "Jim, we'll have to change that priority. Somebody else see." So about three times I changed the priority in one morning. And eventually he looked up at me and said, "Father, working here is like being spancelled to a goat."
But he stuck it out.
Oh, he had a great say. Oh, yeah.
It was great,
a solid job for him,
a great
9 to 5,
yeah.
And he was his own boss in a lot of ways. We knew that.
How long did you spend on there before you came back here?
21
again?
Years.
21
yeah,
years.
Because after that I was elected prior provincial in 1969.
Oh, I see. Yes, and that
kept me occupied for 7 years, you know. So that meant going out to Zimbabwe every so often, out to the missions.
And how did you, I mean, this was now during the 70s, wasn't it?
Yes,
the 70s.
Yes.
And at that stage, numbers weren't falling off too much, but they were beginning.
Well, you've put it nicely now, that's it, they weren't falling off too much. I didn't see the worst of the years, but you could see it was beginning all round. You could see a certain amount of agitation, student agitation everywhere, if you remember. And they mightn't call it agitation, but we did. And even in the seminaries, things were getting difficult. So what I did was I sent all our own seminarians, sent them all out to Rome. I felt that the atmosphere generally was more stable out there. And I never regretted it. And they didn't either, because they loved it.
Yeah, because they weren't getting the harassment, as you said, at home.
No,
When you talk about harassment, what do you mean now?
Exactly? There was a great deal of agitation everywhere, of anti-establishment. Like it percolated not only into the civil institutions, but into the ecclesiastical ones too. It's seminarians looking for rights of all kinds, you know, wanting to wear their hair down to their shoulders. And, you know, you could feel the heat all right. And you see, there was a big anti-authority, or anti-authoritarian, whichever way you like to put it, heave, I use it, in all of society. Yeah. And the church wasn't spared that. And, you know, seminary staffs had to look very hard, sort of responding to it by a big clamp down.
Mm-hmm.
You might find yourself with nobody. Now, some men would say, well, if these guys don't want to accept the system we have, let them go. That, you could sympathize to some extent with that view, but it wasn't the answer. You had to recognize that there was a change in thinking in society, and you had to certainly stand back and assess it and do it carefully and cautiously. And at the end of the day, there might be some people who just wouldn't fit in. But I suppose it's when the word dialogue became a real word in the English language, and you had to be exchanging views with people who before you just told to do it.
So did you think by taking this into, say, by this idea or this plan of bringing the Carmelites over to Rome?
That there was a less contentious climate in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
I felt there was a less contentious climate
in
Rome.
So in that atmosphere, they would train better and they would...
Yes, and there was more stability in their lives.
Yeah. Did it work? Did you see it
did.
Working?
Oh, it did. Oh, it did. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. A very happy decision. I often...
And did you put many, many students...
well, all we had. All we had. All we had. Oh, yes. All we had. And these were decisions you had to make fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be fairly decisive and just hope that you were making the right one. And not everybody would want to go to Rome again, you see. Some, you were asking me about loneliness. Even for adults, a big change of life, a big cultural change, can be devastating. You can have adults suffering from homesickness in a way that little boarders would never be. When you have a complete change. Because if you go to Rome, you picture here, you're in the middle of a lovely oasis of land and water. Rome may be the eternal city, but it's also a city of cobblestone streets everywhere you turn. And it might be a long time before you found a green badge, you
So
know.
you really would feel
Oh yes,
lonely
oh, you
for
oh you would oh yes,
home
and
ground again.
then the Christmases were, their Christmases were indented like ours. St. Francis may have invented the crib, and he did, and they do a lot of those things beautifully. But I
But you
don't
were
think.
very happy to come back again, were
Ah
you?
yeah, well, and I was very happy there once I settled down,
And when you
but.
got back here then in 19 in
54.
1950, yes, but when you got back the second time, when you came in here again,
Yes.
it was 1985.
1985. Well, things had changed a good deal then, you know, and I had, even though I was involved at another level in the finishing of the borders, you know, this is my first experience of the college without borders.
And so was it like coming home again? I
Ah,
mean,
it was. Ah, yes. Ah, yes.
and did you find a lot of your old companions still
Yes.
here?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Now, from memory, I remember a lot of them had had nicknames. I mean,
Oh,
this is
that's. Oh,
what
yes. I, well, we all know that. Oh, yes.
they
We all know
Can you
that.
remind me what some of those names were
Well,
again?
you used to call Father Clark, your Dean of Discipline, they called him Jerry Cack. KAC, signed out in KAC, Kevin Andrew Clark. So the kids just christened him Jerry Cack. Then Father Keenan, who was the Dean of Studies, he sounded as if he was going to devour somebody. He was the most harmless poor man in the world. They called him, because he went with a bit of a swagger when he was chasing the kids, you know, and they called him Mexican Pete. So he was known as Mex. And Father Hager, he was in charge of junior school, they just called him Hago. So nearly everybody had a name. And of course, the priests wouldn't pretend that they knew it, you know. And I had a very good fun with the kids.
And did you find that when corporal punishment went out, because that was there in your
Oh,
time,
yes, oh,
and
yeah,
then it
oh,
went
yeah, oh,
out,
yeah.
did you see a difference, or did you see how it changed?
Oh, yes, oh, it has changed. It has changed considerably. It has changed everything. And the problem now, of course, is I'm glad to see that corporal punishment is no longer part of. It was part of society. Like, people sometimes over-focus on school. Most men would tell you that if they were punished at school for something, they never told their parents. Why? Because they would get a double punishment from their parents, whom we all loved. And so kids never would tell their parents that they got punished that day. The parents would say, well, straight away, well, if you were punished at school, you must have been doing something naughty. And the priest or the teacher or the brother or the sister, whoever it was right. It was a culture of punishment. Now, if there were excesses, nobody can, in any way condone any excesses that were, you know. But so that was the way. Like, corporal punishment, like capital punishment, was a fact of life in society, and we moved on from there. However, there can be very serious disciplinary problems. You get kids who are disruptors. That's a very severe challenge in any school, and my impression is that the department keeps its head down. Doesn't want to know, and I'm told that certainly in some primary schools that a number of teachers have opted out now.
Because they can't handle it.
They can't handle it. Well, it's, you know, you can't handle a disruptor too easily. And if you have a child that's totally out of control at home, you can imagine an unfortunate teacher trying to communicate to the rest of the class. It's just not on, and nobody wants to take responsibility. Now, you have where children need psychiatric treatment, and that, I think, you know, that should be done and it should be given to them. But there can be a lot of pretending, I think, that things are more normal than they are, you know. So many legal ramifications now as to who may be falling down on the job, as to who may be neglecting to take the proper type of remedial action, you know, so the buck can be passed around a bit. That's my impression. But it's a very serious challenge to a number of teachers who've given up.
Yeah. Finally, you're facing the 150th anniversary.
Yes.
Here.
Yes.
Next year.
Yes.
2009. It's a long time. It's still a college which is doing very well and going
yes.
I will be here for a long time to
yes,
come.
It's doing well everywhere, thank God. And of course, we're very fortunate in having so many amenities. You see, it was out in the country at one stage. Now it's an oasis in a concrete desert. And we're very fortunate, I suppose, being part of the Green Belt, because directly opposite us, which was originally part of the whole Terranure estate anyhow, the Bushy Park across the road, which is a public park, that it was all part of the one property at one stage.
Yeah.
The old steam tram to Blessington
cut
through there. That's why the road is straight. Across from one the old cow made. was deliberately cut. But I think that's it's doing very well. There are plenty of amenities. It has, you know, plenty of space now for good spacious classrooms. There'll be a lot of extra classrooms built on, you know, modern in every sense of the word. The sports amenities are second to none.
But I'm going to ask you finally, this is the very final question. You must have, looking back now over all those years,
yes,
the highs and the lows, what would have been, in your memory, the high points in your life as a Carmelite?
The high points of my life? Well, personally, the high points would have been, I loved the 10 years I was here. That was one continual high point.
That was the first 10 years.
Yes. And then my years in White Friars Street were totally different. But I would have to say they were a very high point too. It was totally different. And I had Fulton Sheen over four times from America. The greatest televangelist ever. And the people were out in the street. That was a great time for me personally, because it was a bit of a challenge to bring him. The good man came and he wasn't disappointed, nor were we. And I've loved all the triumphs of the college, the cups they've won. And I always love when I hear that they're satisfied with the exam results. That's been a very, very good year. Mm-hmm. It mightn't have all the A students in the world here, but we have a very good, solid standard that brings 90% of our students into third level education. And I think that's one of the ways to look at it. And by the way, we're discussing this in the context of some sad days for the GAA as the men in Cork battle it out with the Cork County Board. What a lot of people don't know is that the first college in Ireland to be affiliated with the GAA was Terranure College in 1885, 1 year after the foundation of the GAA. Yeah, the first college, and it's recognised, it's in the records, and it's in the records in Croke Park. Something that a lot of people don't know. And we still have GAA teams here all the time. So they play every sport. Yeah. And lots of the kids go on to excel with their counties and that. Yeah. Like one of Anthony Stokes, one of Roy Keane's best men at the moment in Sunderland, is a past pupil. Yeah. So I'm just talking about the variety, you know.
Yeah.
So,
what were the low points then into your life be?
Well, the low point was when I had to leave here in 64.
That was
a very low point.
Yeah.
And that, that really was, and a very high point. I brought the St. Tray's National Office, by the way, is based here. And if you remember the Journey of the Relics around Ireland 2001, that was organised by me from here.
Was it
Yes, in
Saint
that,
Teresa's
yeah,
relics?
yeah, in 2001.
You organized
Yes,
that.
I was the national coordinator, yes.
Yes,
Yeah.
that was a great success.
Well, that, well, you asked me for a high point. I couldn't believe it. As we went from place to place, the crowds got bigger. That 75% of the population, the Sunday Business Post, the day we were returning the relics to Lisieux on the 2nd of July 2001, after 84 days here. So the Business Post spoke of it as the greatest mass movement of Irish people in the history of the state. So that was organised. The national office is here, so that's a very happy. We can't use the word proud about Saint Therese because she's the great saint of humility, but we were very happy to have been her instruments in the, and it was a great spiritual movement, and thousands of people were reconciled to their faith. That to me was the great fruit of that. The number of people who went to confession were 20 and 30 years away and came back to the practice of their faith. That to me was a very, very high point in my life. And we were exhausted at the end of it, but pleasantly so. 84 days on the road, all of Ireland's 26 dioceses, every county, including your native Kerry. As a matter of fact, one of our priests who's died since, he had just celebrated his Golden Jubilee, Father Elton Griffin, a Cork man, and he had been invited by the Bishop of Kerry to give a triduum in honour of St. Therese in preparation for the coming of the relics to St. Brendan's Cathedral in Killarney. And he wrote an intercom afterwards, that's the clerical magazine. He said, "I've just celebrated 50 years of priesthood, and I can without hesitation say that the greatest night of my 50 years was the night in Killarney when the relics of St. Therese came there."
Well, no, and my goodness, and it all hemmed and from your doing and
Well,
your
it was
organization,
coordinated from here,
yes,
and as
yeah.
I say, I was very humbled by it in the end.
Well, Father Joseph Ryan, it has been a pleasure sitting down here and talking to you in Terenure College.
Yes.
Thank you indeed.
So I didn't know what you